Jai Guru, everyone.
Jai Guru.
Jai Guru.
Welcome to Chapter 11, Part 4 of the Autobiography of a Yogi Line by Line podcast. We are here with the full gang. How is everyone?
Great, thank you.
I like how we said Jai Guru one after another this time. Usually we all say at the same time. Yeah.
Really? Oh. What was the order?
I don't know, it was natural. Just came. Yeah. Didn't need
one. Must have order. So this episode is the last part of chapter 4. Relatively short chapter in terms of parts, especially in comparison to the previous, and most certainly in comparison to what's coming up next, which Chris will enlighten us on at the end of the episode. So this last section of chapter 11 is really about a few things, about the gratitude of the new disciple, which is Pratap. Also then Mukunda and Jitendra return back to Agra, and then they can liaise with Ananta, who is very surprised. And then they go back to Calcutta, at which point Jitendra leaves Mukunda, and somewhat of a cliffhanger ending where Mukunda is right at the front gate of Swami Sukadeshwara Serampur Ashram, and that's where it ends. So, and then we'll hopefully reflect on the chapter as a whole and look ahead to the upcoming chapter. So that's that. So the first part that we're going to discuss is really about the joy that was shared between Jitendra, between Pratap, and between Mukunda. So what happened? So they were about to, well, they boarded the train, but Jitendra was in tears again, which is very cool, because Mukunda is obviously very happy and joyful because Pratap has been initiated, and you know, he's re-established his link with Pratap, no doubt, and he's had a very successful venture. But Jitendra is in tears, so nice duality there, but tears of a different kind. So Pratap was also crying because he had, you know, met his guru again. Mike?
Yeah, I was gonna remark something on Jitendra, because we talked about it a bit in the last episode, but Guruji says that it was his day for tears. And I wonder how it would be for me to just go somewhere and have where nobody, and I just say, I just trust in God to just care for me for the one day. And then he cares for you so amazingly well. So you feel this love from God, for God. And maybe it's tears, but I don't know if he's sad. He might be actually in a state that is very, very nice and full of God's love.
So if you were in tears, would they be, if in this position, would they be tears of joy and gratitude? Or would they be tears, as Jitendra describes, this time is against himself, a welter of grief? So those are certainly tears of disappointment in oneself, at his folly and his lack of faith. How would which category would you be in, Mike?
Yeah, I think it's a bit of both, but when my mind keeps telling me, "Oh, Mike, you did something bad. You have to now suffer for this," I always just turn it off. So I don't do that too much. I don't dwell on past things too much. So I feel like the state that he's in right now is like the one that God is actually taking care of himself. And I think that it must be the positive must, or at least in my case, the positive would be the one that predominant.
Would you be laughing in joy, or would you actually be in tears? Had it have been you?
That tears and joy together is not a bad combination. It's like, you know, you have so much joy that the tears come out. Yeah.
I love when Mike was saying that he's got his optimism on off switch and he can just switch into optimism mode. Chris was rightly applauding. What a fantastic capability that would be if we all would have
that. Not optimism. I can just turn off the torture switch.
You know, like... Potato, potato. So,
not a glutton for punishment, Mike.
He's pretty good at optimism, I must say. Anti-cynicism. So what happens next? So it was an emotional, seems to have been an emotional day for Pratap. And he was tearful because he essentially, you know, had a reunion with his guru and now he has to leave his guru. Perhaps this is the last time in this life he shall physically see his guru again. We obviously don't know if Pratap, you know, came back to see him in Serampore or they kept in touch, or maybe he saw him when he came back to India in 1935. We don't know. Let's assume that they never saw each other again. So in this would be another potential reason for tears. But I was thinking of my own Kriya initiation. Obviously, we're not going to talk about the Kriya itself, but we can talk about the impact of it. So mine was much more of a slow burner because I didn't realize the significance of it. I just thought it was a natural progression. You know, I was getting on well with my lessons and I was having a good relationship with Guruji's teachings. So I just took the Kriya initiation without really that much thought into what it actually means. So like after I had my initiation, I just carried on about my sadhana with an extra practice, with a bit more reverence for Guruji, but nothing to the extent that Pratap here and later Ananta will see later feels. Chris?
Yeah, it's an interesting moment to be a bit more introspective on this because it is a bit of a whirlwind, isn't it? You know, all the occurrence and going, getting your career and all the rest of it in hindsight, it all happens quite quickly, right? For me, whenever I saw that you made a note to talk about this, Priyank, it gave me flashbacks of the moment and you were there and Mike was there. And I think if it wasn't for my pride, I definitely would have been shedding a tear or two more than what I did, because I was really blown away and I was thinking actually why. So it was quite good that you brought this up. To Mike's point earlier, that he may have an ability to switch off, you know, this self-punishment, side of self-punishment. I think at that moment, I was so grateful actually to be accepted into the SRF family for the memory of the sins I've done, you know, physically, verbally, you know, through thought, and all these moments where the forgiveness and the acceptance is there from the guru, no matter what, you know, but it is such a beautiful moment, really, to reflect on. And I thought to myself here with Pratap, what an enlightened soul he must be to first have Krishna come to him and then have Guruji there and being able to help in this pivotal moment. And we're now all reflecting on it. So, yeah, it's all a beautiful moment that we're observing here.
Oh, wow. Didn't realize you're right. It would be a benefit to do it without anyone that you know. It's, as you say, a bit of pride. So Chris and Lauren in the last 12 months had their career.
You did well, Chris. You did well. Yeah.
Thank you. I'll be together.
Lauren, did you know absolutely anyone there when you had yours?
Well, I strangely enough, I'm not sure if anyone was in the actual ceremony that I knew. I'm not sure, but there was someone that I'd been in touch with prior to going to America. He was a young adult in Encinitas, and you know, his girlfriend and partner was being initiated at the same time. So as I came, as I walked into the Mother Center grounds, there he was, and he was like, "Oh, hi, Laura." Karen, but I was having a day in silence, so I just had to, you know, wave. So and we'd never met before. We'd only text. So I don't know if he was actually in there or not. But yeah, no, it was a room full of well, familiar strangers, I guess. But yeah, it was, yeah. I didn't actively know anybody, so it's very special.
Very nice. Yeah. I actually knew no one. I knew no one there. I just started coming to the center that week, actually. No, maybe a couple of weeks before that. Mike, did you know anyone during your ceremony?
I did a convocation, so I knew a ton of people, actually. But I don't know if any of them actually got initiated the same day I got. So most of them, they were, but there were a ton of people there that I knew, definitely.
And were you emotional after, or were you just like me?
No, I think at this point, I grew up in an SRF family, and it was kind of the expectation for me to get Kriya at some point.
like getting your university out of the way.
Yeah, a bit like that, yeah.
The spiritual university phase.
So those were still the days when I kind of felt I do this, and so my parents are happy and stuff. So yeah.
Remember, this was in 2012 and I got initiated, and I'd just got married a few months beforehand, and it was my sister-in-law's wedding during my initiation time, and there was an engagement ceremony of which it was the same time as the Kriya initiation, and I was like, oh, God, I missed this. I've got an engagement. And they were like, what could possibly be more important than your sister's engagement? And I was like, how do I explain? Wow. How do I explain this? But yeah, it didn't go down too well.
But, what did you say, Priyank? What was your reason? How did you word it?
I did tell them, but in my family's, in my in-law's family, Diksha, which we're going to describe a bit later, it means when you become a renunciant, when you join the sannyasi. And so I said, Diksha, and I said, you can't be a swami, you're a married. You just got married. So there was like this whole host of confusion around it. But I explained it, but they didn't, because it's not in their culture, they didn't understand what the significance of it was. Because in their mind, you only swamis take this oath. And we're going to talk about the oath a bit later when Ananta takes it. But yeah, it was a difficult conversation, which they didn't understand. Now they have begun to understand it, because a few of the other members of the family have become initiated, so they now know what it means. So only took a decade to be understood.
It's better late than never, Frank.
Seek first to understand and then to be understood. Sorry, Mike.
Earth has a long arch. Yeah, similar sort of patience.
Indeed. So Jitendra, this time it says that he was grieving not for himself, but against himself. Now, I've read this a few times. I re-went over the chapter, and I can't understand how previously when he was grieving, it wasn't for himself. I thought it was against him. So last time he was crying was because the Gorima, mother said, you know, I've prepared a delicious meal for you. And he was obviously very hungry. And miraculously, they got their first, you know, meal, first objective. Ananda's first objective was met. And then he burst into tears. So I'm still yet to unravel that. Lauren?
No, you go first. You go, perhaps.
No, go.
Well, I wondered if, you know, when we're crying for ourselves, it's kind of more of an insular, perhaps even positive caring experience, because you're grieving because you care about yourself and, you know, all of that. But when you're against yourself, you realize that you've done wrong, right? And this is what this feels like to me for Jitendra. He's crying, he's weeping out of kind of anguish against himself, whereas before it was like, oh, what a blessing, I can't believe I missed it. But this time it's like, oh my gosh, what have I done? And that kind of feels like the difference here between the two.
Very, very, very succinctly expressed. I was going to allude to that very haphazardly, but because I'm not very good at crying, perhaps I can't really relate to this. So very well expressed, Lauren. I think you're absolutely right. So yes, in terms of against yourself, Guruji talks about types of the seeker of truth, or the types of spiritual seekers in lesson 19. So you can read all about that. There's four different types, and you can see which category you fall into, and which category you think Jitendra may fall into if you have that lesson. These are the new lessons format. So next is Jitendra says, how shallow my trust. My heart has been stone. Never in future shall I doubt God's protection. Chris, do you believe that statement? Never in future shall I doubt God's protection.
So I think that this is a moment where Jitendra will stand the test of time, where it is going to be true for him, because in the moment he's got these emotions where he is feeling grief, he's crying, as Yogananda says, against himself. So I think he's very charged with emotions. He is seeing things very clearly. And this, Yogananda says, is a way to speak with conviction and emotions. And then that will be true. You know, you can really bring that into reality. So it's a way to use speech. And it strikes me as one of those moments for Jitendra here. And it rings true to my life as well, where I've had moments where I have spoken with conviction, and I remember those moments and said, I will either do something from this day onwards. And one of the more funny ones, more lighthearted ones, let's say, is coffee. I think almost this time last year, I said I would never drink coffee or caffeine again. And I haven't touched stuff since. Anyway, I think it's just funny. Maybe we all have a moment like that or two that we remember, but I'm sure Jitendra, given the circumstances, will stay true to his word here.
I think you're right, Chris, as well. It's like, you know, when we are in those moments and we say things, when we remember them, when we're in perhaps a moment of like struggle or doubt or whatever, that feeling comes back, doesn't it? It's like, oh yeah, I remember that feeling. But something I've also noticed with me is that if I make a strong statement like that, it seems that all tests come to see if that's really true. So now I've kind of got into the habit of not saying a thing aloud, or perhaps sometimes not even thinking it, because it just invites a whole lot of Maya just to test me, you know. So there's probably a balance, isn't there, as with all things.
I think you guys are all too positive, so I need to be the
this
the
is rare, surprise. Rare.
Because it's a really big statement. He will never doubt the protection of God again. I mean, that is, you see avatars doing that. So I don't know if that's not maybe something a bit too ambitious for him. And like Priyag said, he's not gonna join him to go to Sri Yukteswar later. So it doesn't really take long for him to go off that spiritual path with Yogananda. But I do believe that this was probably a big moment in his life, and he will think back to that often. And whenever he feels like he detracts too far from the spiritual path, he will think of that, and it will help him correct.
I was thinking about affirmations, especially when I was thinking about how I read this. And often the affirmations are exceptionally profound and very, very far from where we may actually be in our current state of spiritual evolution, yet we still affirm them, and in the hope that we'll slowly, you know, go towards there. And as Lauren said, sometimes then the divine hand like gives you some accelerated test to you know, test your resolve and obviously improve you quicker than what would otherwise have been the case had you not have made that affirmation or promise or dedication. But I'm also reminded in that, Lauren, so we can take encouragement of the quote, an easy life is not a victorious life. So one of challenges and tests and trials is one that accelerates our spiritual growth. Chris?
Yeah. The last episode, I think I mentioned the five stages of the heart with Sri Yukteswar. So what do you guys think this stage is, and has he evolved from one stage to the other, from, say, dark to propelled, propelled to steady, steady to devoted, devoted to clean? Because he says here, how shallow my trust, my heart has been stone.
I'd say so, he's moved up. I don't know. Has he?
He's leveled up, has he?
He propelled. I feel like he's propelling himself. So he's going to the stage two.
Or is he going into steady?
He's slowly steadying, yeah.
I think he's maybe getting into the steady here, or devoted, I don't know. He's certainly moving up the stages, isn't he?
Yes. In the lesson that I referenced earlier, chapter in lesson 19, there's a section that's entitled The Devotee of Changeable Enthusiast. So we can certainly apply that to probably us, and most certainly Jitendra, because we know what's about to transpire. So let's move on. So midnight was approaching, and the tale is reaching its crescendo, isn't it, this chapter? And Guruji describes the two Cinderellas, and he puts that in quotes, sent forth penniless, entered Ananta's bedroom. So now, obviously, this is their reunion with Ananta, and this is going to be the crux of the chapter. But before we talk about the conversation with Ananta, seeing as Guruji has used the fairy tale reference of Cinderella, I don't know how you all feel about the fairy tale of Cinderella, but even though I probably haven't read it since childhood, I could pretty much quote exactly what happens in the whole narrative of Cinderella. That may not be the case, certainly, for all readers of the autobiography of a yogi. Cinderella is certainly a much more popular Western fairy tale classic than it is an Eastern one. So we'll briefly go through what Cinderella, what he's referring to, and what the reference is in a second. But before we do that, Mike?
The German contribution to Western culture, Cinderella, from Brothers Grimm's. And I think what the one thing that is paralleled between Cinderella and here is that they had to be home before midnight. So I guess that's the only real parallel I would know how to draw between those two stories. Do you have anything on top of that?
I do. I was going to get there. But before we do that, who wants to run through what Cinderella, the actual story was, very briefly? Anyone?
Given that you said you read.
I did reread it, but I thought it would be nicer to have an unpolished version than someone else.
I can do it.
Go on, Lauren.
Okay. So you have a family with a stepmother, her two daughters, and Cinderella. Cinderella is basically treated as the family slave because her father isn't there, and she gets mistreated by her mother and her two stepsisters, and she has to do lots of household chores and scrub floors, and it's a very unfair, unfortunate life for poor Cinderella, until one day she wants to go to this grand ball that the prince invites everyone to, and her stepmother says she can't go. So she's there scrubbing the floors, she's crying, and up comes the fairy godmother and basically turns her into a princess for the evening. And she goes to the ball, she meets the prince, they fall in love. But the deal is she has to be home by 12 p.m. Otherwise, all her lovely dress mm-hmm. and her facade will be gone. So she's having a great time at the ball when suddenly she hears the clock striking 12 because she's been having such a great time. She's not had her eye on the time. So she runs away from the prince, and she's running so fast she leaves her slipper. And the prince doesn't catch Cinderella in time before she leaves, but he does catch the slipper that she leaves behind. So he goes on a quest to find out who this woman is that he met at the ball. And he goes around the whole of the town trying the shoe on every young lady until eventually he comes to Cinderella and they live happily ever after.
I'm glad you stopped there, because there's a very interesting last bit of that. A very exceptionally well narrated story, Lauren. Beautifully summarized. Very well done. Sounds like you've done a play or two, perhaps, with Cinderella.
I have. Professionally. Wow. Yes, back in my acting days.
Amazing. So before we go to that last two lines that you said, where he finds her, let's read out what actually happens, because I think there's some significance in there.
Okay. The prince could not take his eyes off Cinderella. "I believe I have found my princess," he said, and he suddenly fell to one knee. "My dear Cinderella," he said, "will you please marry me?" "Yes," Cinderella cried, and with that, her stepmother fainted. The prince took Cinderella's hand and escorted her to his royal carriage. Suddenly, 6 grey mice and a fat rat climbed on top of the carriage. "What are they doing?" the prince wanted to know. "They are my friends," Cinderella said joyously. "Then they too shall be royalty," the prince said. He was so overcome with love and joy that he married Cinderella that very day. They lived happily ever after.
So, for those who don't remember, the significance of the 6 grey mice and the fat rat, do either of you remember about that particular part of the story?
No.
So if you remember in the story that Lauren just said, so when the fairy godmother, you know, gave her all these the dress and made her look very pretty, she had to go to the ball. But how did she get there? Chariot. Mm-hmm. She conjured a chariot. But the chariot needs horses. Mm-hmm. Needs a charioteer. So Cinderella had some friends, which were mice and rats, no doubt, that lived, you know, with her, her only friends, perhaps, and quite lowly friends, you might say. But she remembered them, you know, because mm-hmm. So what happened is the fairy godmother then converted or transformed those rats into horses and, you know, a charioteer. So here is the relevance, I think. So then it's a stretch, but you know, let me take it. So then at the end of the thing, end of the, you know, she could have just said goodbye to that part of her life, but she remembered her very lowly friends and she took them with her. And, you know, the prince was like, what are these mice and rats? But she insisted that they come. And then he said, they are my friends. And she took them. Now, Mike, what similar story or the poem is there that Guruji, how that could be related to our teachings? Can I give you a clue? The story.
Yeah, give me a clue.
Right behind your head.
Right behind my head, the boatman.
Yes. Guruji takes who? All of us. Lowly, miserable
right.
souls.
Right? Yeah, nice. Yeah.
It was a stretch, but I'm glad you allowed me. So no, Cinderella, nice. Cinderella remembered. And of course, Guruji, with his eternal promise, will be taking us with him to the other side. Sorry?
Bravo.
Thank you. It's all Guruji.
Connecting the dots. Yeah.
Sent forth penniless, entered Ananta's bedroom, these two Cinderellas. Just as he had lightly predicted, his face was a study of astonishment. And you'll recall that what he actually predicted was that if you return to my bungalow here and before 12 o'clock tonight without having broken any rule of my test, I shall be the most astonished man in Agra. And he, you know, he fulfilled his own prophecy there, which is quite nice. So he then Mukunda silently, I love this, silently showered a table with rupee notes. You could just imagine like a young Mukunda like really gloating with this.
Mic drop.
Not only have I succeeded, but here is the wealth I've acquired through God and his infinite mercy. Ananta is obviously laughing at this point, and he turns to Jitendra and tells him, you know, jokingly, what, tell me this youngster, has he been staging a holdup? So Ananta then, sorry, Jitendra then tells Ananta the whole story, and Ananta, going from the jovial laughing expression, his face turns sober and then solemn, which is quite nice. And his face did not turn pale here, because we'll remember that Indians struggle to turn pale, obviously depending on their complexion, but yes. So then Mukunda has quite a profound, this has a very profound impact on Ananda, doesn't it? He says the law of, yeah, Mike?
No, read that. I want to comment on this.
The law of demand and supply reaches into subtler realms than I had supposed. Ananda spoke with a spiritual enthusiasm never before noticeable. I understand for the first time your indifference to the vaults and vulgar accumulations of the world.
I find this, you know, sometimes you have to explain something to somebody. You have to pick them up from where they are and bring them to the place that you want them to see. And I find when he mentions the law of demand and supply from economics, I feel like that's how his brain works. You know, you give and you take, and that's how the life works. And now when he says this law reaches into the higher realms, that kind of means that there is more than just that. But it's beautifully, that the way they communicate with each other, either Ananta was like half a poet or something, but he's like, the way he talks is really profound and really, really, really tells a story, this analogy that he makes there.
It's beautiful, isn't it? It also reminds me of the quote in the front of the book that says, unless you see signs and wonders, you will not believe. And it's another example of that, isn't it? And Ananta really had to see the miracle of God's work in action through his brother to finally bow down at God's feet and accept his presence.
And all of us receive or see different categories of signs and wonders, don't we?
Yeah, exactly.
Some are blessed to have absolute astonishing miracles. Some, you know, it's very subtle. Others see the spiritual eye on the first time that they close their eyes in the chapel, and the rest of us might have to work decades or perhaps lifetimes to achieve that similar feat. Chris?
Yeah, I was going to say something similar. You know, we have a whole word dedicated to dismissing this phenomenon, which is a coincidence. You know, life is a coincidence. And we'd like to sort of box that away into things we simply can't understand without investigating further. So yeah, it's, you guys said it well, it's poetic, it's a lovely moment, isn't it?
But if you think about the context of Ananda's life, he was essentially a cynic, wasn't he? A spiritual cynic, you might say, or a man of religion from an arm's length, you know, as long as it fits into my life, then I'll partake in it, essentially. But his life was the priority, as opposed to God being the priority, I think. But here he's doing a 180 flip, isn't he? And in the context of his life, let's say he's 30 years old right now, or 25, let's say, he's switched very, very quickly, because up to the 24 years and 364 days, he was a doubter, you know, a cynic, a critic, even, as we've seen, quite a harsh critic. And within a day, you can see something very, very serious has touched his soul, hasn't it? He's switched. And this is what happens, isn't it? If you've been through something like this, when you change very, very quickly. So this is something perhaps some of us can relate to. I certainly can. Mike?
I would cut Ananta a lot of slack in this life, because he was a tough life, because the mom passed away early. And so as an Indian oldest brother, a lot of the chores would fall on his shoulders, I would think. And I don't think he meant badly for any of his brothers, especially Mukunda, but he just wanted him to aspire to the goals that he set for himself. And Mukunda had different goals, and that was where all the conflict stemmed from. Mm-hmm. And then coming around after so many years takes an enormous amount of self-reflection, because I feel the older you get, the more you get set in your ways, and the more you would just say, oh, this is just my crazy brother. But instead, he, like you said, he did a 180. That's pretty impressive.
I wonder how much of a 180 he actually did. Because, you know, just because Ananta was saying all of these mocking things to Mukunda doesn't mean he wasn't slightly becoming more open to it and intrigued. And for him to say, oh, if you come back here tonight, I will become your disciple. I mean, that kind of already says, well, it felt like more of an open invitation in a way. So I wonder if it's, even though it is 180, just how much of a sharp 180 it's been and for how long. For that, only Ananta knows.
All right, I'm willing to concede it's a 175. Is that acceptable?
Ever precise.
Is that acceptable?
Yes.
Yeah, Mike, good point there. And that's a point about Ananta. That's a point we're going to reflect on, I think, at the concluding point of this. That's one of the points that I wanted to make. So he says, Lenny says, he insists that his brother initiate him or receive Diksha into Kriya Yoga. So the footnote very beautifully describes Diksha as the root word is Diksha, which is to dedicate oneself. And I think this is such a good explanation, because I've really struggled. This is how I described it recently to my family. You know, like in the London Centre, last year we had, was it nearly 200, over 100, nearly 150 initiates and Kriya initiates, of which Chris was one. So we had to have two ceremonies, which is the first time in the London Centre, because of that number of people. We couldn't accommodate, even though our chapel is pretty big, as you three know. But when I explained to my family, you know, 150 people are going to take Diksha, they thought, oh my God, you're going to have 150 Swamis in London. And then I had to really explain, I had to go to what Diksha means. And I went to the Sanskrit and explained it's about, you know, dedicating and pledging your allegiance to the guru and all those things that we know. But only then did they understand. And I think only at that point, Lauren, did they understand why I had to miss the engagement.
Ah.
Chris.
Yeah, it's very meaningful for myself. In that I actually got onto the path in end of 2016, but didn't really take my Kriya until just last year, 2023. And I purposely waited until I was confident myself that I was sufficiently dedicated to the path and practicing, you know, doing the rituals exactly how Yogananda said to do, because I'd done it to a degree up to say, you know, 3, 4, 5 months, and then my world flipped upside down with, you know, living on a boat and moving country, and then I didn't practice it as much as I should have at the time. So I delayed it until I was 100% committed and dedicated to the practice day in, day out. So it really does speak to me hearing this word. Actually didn't know it before, but that's what it means to me, that dedication, the relationship between the devotee and the guru. So it's nice.
Beautiful. Nice. Beautiful. So the Guru Mukunda had to shoulder in one night the responsibility of two unsought disciples. Disciples is in quotes there, because and Guru is in quotes because he's obviously a boy or a man of 18, so very young, and hence he's emphasizing that Mukunda had his shoulder, and he's referring to himself in third person. So he's giving a lot of emphasis on the surprising element that this, you know, this essentially not a very conventional thing to happen to anyone, let alone an 18-year-old boy or man, and very unconventional because both were unsought. He didn't speak out these people, certainly not Pratap, but almost definitely not Ananta. That's probably, don't know which one is actually the bigger surprise. complete stranger or your older brother, which culturally would be against the grain. We can listeners can make up their own mind on that. So that's the end of that exchange. I will reflect a little bit on what that exchange means and some of our theories for it a bit at the end of this episode. But let's move on to this Taj Mahal section. So the breakfast next morning was apparently in complete harmony, which is rare for Mukunda and Ananta, it would seem, which is why he, I think, had felt the need to be explicit about that, because I'm sure the four of us are used to having breakfast in harmony, so who wouldn't think to make a point that had been absent the previous preceding morning, because they had that big debate and bet about, you know, Mukunda living on father's money, etc. So Mukunda smiled at Jitendra and said, "You shall not be cheated of the Taj." Mm-hmm. Let us view it before starting for Sirampur. So you'll remember God's boatman, Guruji promising to take, you know, every single last one of us back to the shores of his heavenly father, to whom we all adore. But there's also here Mukunda is not allowing even this little, you know, promise of seeing the Taj Mahal. He's not setting a bad example. He's even fulfilling that for little Jitendra. Chris, would you like to read what, you know, Guruji's promise is? I've got a nice quote here.
"He who shall receive with open heart shall never go away unfulfilled. His or her heart shall be a wonderful cup that will gradually expand into an eternal vessel to receive the ocean of infinity and the power of spirit."
Beautiful. So that's our guru there for us, not just the Taj Mahal, but I think the Taj Mahal is slightly symbolic, as we'll go to in a minute. So they said goodbye to Ananta, and they were there quite close to Agra, obviously, already, because that's where Ananta was living. So they probably took a horse carriage. And they set their eyes on the dazzling marble stands a vision of pure symmetry. And I can certainly resonate with that. I absolutely love symmetry. I remember Chris, when Zoe was there, she was teaching me some art at one stage. She's a very accomplished painter. So this Zoe is someone from the London Centre who's sadly passed now. She was, she said on the first lesson, she said, bring all your kit and we'll see what we can do. And I bought my like stencils, rulers, engineering pencils, mechanical pencils and ruler, you know, all the things that I would draw with precision with. And she's like, no, put them all to one side. You only need a pencil and your eye, you know, and you need a very free hand and a free wrist. So I remember this, you know, this is the extent to how much I love symmetry. So when I was first seeing the Taj Mahal, I was like standing at the most symmetrical spot, looking from side to side, seeing if I could see any flaw. And I could not see a single, and even this last time that I went, I still could not see a single flaw. It is that majestic and beautiful. My wife said that I asked her, did it live up to the hype? And she said it exceeded the hype. She said it's the only place I've been to where everyone makes a big deal out of it. And not only is it true, but it's actually, you have to go there to experience that. It's better than words can describe, which is quite a testimony. So it says here, the perfect setting is dark cypress, glossy lawn, tranquil lagoon. The interior is exquisite with lace-like carvings inlaid with semi-precious stones. Delicate wraiths and scrolls emerge intricately from the marbles, brown and violet. The illumination from the dome falls on the cenotaphs of Emperor Shah Jahan and Mumtaz E Mahal, the queen of his realm and heart. Very beautifully described. Yeah, Mike?
I just want to quickly share what I felt when I saw the Taj Mahal for the first time, because usually when you go to those, like I mostly know places in Europe that have like mostly medieval, sometimes slightly older structures. And but what struck me with the Taj Mahal was that it looks amazing from far away. And then you got closer and closer, and then you see it doesn't stop. You look at the wall and there's like little patterns everywhere. there's not one piece of it that isn't artistically designed and put a lot of work into the, especially in the time that it was created, it must have been such a amount of work, but also perfect. Like, it doesn't have any faults anywhere. Like you said, it's symmetry, or like Guruji says, it has this symmetry and it has all those shapes and patterns, and no matter if you're close up or far away, it's always a masterpiece.
Indeed. And my wife also said that she thinks because of its the purpose of its reason for it being built, some of you will know that his, you know, Shah Jahan, who's the emperor, his wife passed away during childbirth of their 14th or something child. And because she was loved so much, instead of just building a, you know, standard tomb for her, he built this colossal, you know, monument, essentially, which rivals anything in the, you know, in Islamic art across Persia. And not rivals, that probably exceeds it, doesn't it? And because of that, because usually tombs are just for, you know, famous people, famous spiritual people that, you know, your kings, essentially. So you get elaborate ones, but this is the first one. Mumtaz herself was not of any renown, right? She, the wife of an emperor, rarely ever gets any you know, mention in the annals of history. But here, this is not just an annal, this is one of the most beautiful structures ever created. So she said that the reason that it was made, i.e. out of love, has really propelled it through the ages and made it into the greatness and how adored it is around the world, which I thought was which is another nice reflection on it. But Mike, can you read out what it's spiritual? I think there's a spiritual elements that I think what make it also appealing as well. So Mike, can you read that out?
The promise of Allah, as written in the Quran, is inscribed in marble on the portal of the main entrance to the Taj Mahal, symbolic of the gateway through which Muhammad entered paradise. It is a place of transition between the world of the senses and realm of the spirit.
And if you go to the Taj Mahal, those words will ring true, because it's kind of all enclosed. And then you peer through it in some arches, and then you think, oh, this is some very faraway monument, and then as you go through the archway, it becomes more and more paradise as closer as you get to it, as is described in the inscription from the Quran on the actual Taj Mahal itself. So all of these stuff, all these things, all these elements, I think, contribute to making it such a beautiful place. And Mukunda has also been more than once. He went when he was 18 here, and we also know that he went when in 1935. We have that wonderful picture of him and some of the other devotees that went with him when he went back to India after his sojourn in the West. So I think the other quick thing that I want to mention is the last line here says, the domes falls on the cenotaphs of Emperor Shah Jahan and Mumtaz E Mahal, queen of his realm and his heart. I thought that was so romantic, isn't it? It kind of transcends romance, doesn't it? Because it's going beyond like the physical impression left in this life. You know, it's merging into the eternal relationship, isn't it? So I thought that was really, really quite profound. What a beautiful way to say it. I've read many tributes to the Taj Mahal, but Mukunda has just nailed it with that line. I think that you slipped in the description of the majestic place, Mike.
They say often in art that art is being used to process things that happen to you emotionally, and probably Shah Jahan loved his wife a lot and had this pain when she was gone, and then needed to turn it into something. And then he had the means to create this amazing masterpiece. He had the best artists and the best craftsmen. And then, yeah, those kind of things happen. And now it's a monument to also to love in a marriage. And it's also, like you said, the spiritual monument of transition from one world to the other.
Yeah. One of the other beautiful elements of it is that it's an amalgam of Indian art and architecture and Islamic and Persian art and architecture. Mm. So they've taken almost the best of both, but not just taken them, they've like blended and harmonized. So you'll look on one little facet of it and you'll see ancient India, and you'll look across or look above it and you'll see Persia and, you know, the Arab world and their architecture with the domes. So it's just a phenomenal place. I'm sure when you go there, Lauren, you will concur.
One day, perhaps.
When you return home.
Yes.
And speaking of returning home. So enough of sightseeing, Mukunda says. He says that I was longing for my guru. And I think there's a small message here for us that we shouldn't spend too long in our lives sightseeing. Pilgrimage is as valuable, if not more valuable. And he was now surely making the final pilgrimage to his spiritual home, which is in Serampore. So they were traveling to Bengal now. They've had enough now. Vrindavan and Agra is enough. I suppose it would be two majestic places. So Mukunda, this is now Jitendra speaking. I have not seen my family for months. I have changed my mind. Perhaps later I shall visit your master in Serampore.
Perhaps,
good one, yeah. Lauren. Not a date, not no. And here his hand is fully revealed, isn't it? You know, I was asking in jest earlier where, can he make such a big statement as never will I. You know, lose faith in God, and you could suggest that he's almost lost it here, or forgetting slightly, or putting it to the priorities, changing the priority. I remember I was listening to an SRF talk, and the brother was saying that often we have devotees that say, you know, I really love all of Guruji's teachings and I really want to get enlightened, but not right now, you know. Now is not a good time for me, you know. My son is doing XYZ and I've got a wonderful social life and my life is just really beautiful right now, and I just, you know, just not right now. If I can choose, then that would be really good. And brother was saying, if only they knew what they're pushing to one side or further down the road. But here you get a similar feeling for poor little Jitendra, don't you, Mike?
I think I'm going to spoil the story a little bit now, but there's this one time Sri Yukteswar said that there are people who lose everything, their loved ones leave them, and they lose all their money and stuff. And then they say, I'm going to renounce the world. And then he says, like, what are you renouncing? The world has renounced you. and I understand, but it's so beautiful that Guruji gave us a path that is a bit of a hybrid path, right? We're in the world, but we are also yogis. We have our priority as being a yogi, but we also, doesn't mean you cannot have a social life and those kind of things. So I find it's kind of the best of both worlds.
Indeed. Brother, in that talk that I mentioned, I just recalled as you were saying, Mike, he said, if only this person, you know, the person that said, you know, now is not a good time for me to be enlightened, he said, if that person knew what being enlightened meant or what would be the outcome, then they would not stop meditating. Literally, they would not stop meditating until they'd attained that state, let alone all these social engagements and wonderful aspects of their life that they, you know, they have. So that, apparently that applies to us as well, because we're doing this
podcast. I was going to say that, yeah.
Because we're doing this podcast rather than meditating. And you listeners, you're listening to this rather than meditating. Hopefully this is slightly better than just general, you know, merriment, yes, and social interactions, yeah. Yeah. Tea with friends. But also, as for Lauren's and some other of the young adults are popping over to my house tomorrow. We've got we're gonna do a kirtan and a meditation and various other things. So hopefully these kind of social interactions are a bit more in keeping with the fellowship and other elements that help our spiritual growth as well. Looking forward to that, Lauren. So the other thing I was going to say was that I'm sure we know and have experienced Jitendras in our lives. I certainly have. And one of my friends really is moved by this, because she, when she joined, she went all in. She essentially joined and went to an ashram for like a year and just literally left her job and all these drastic things. And I was speaking to her and she said, I can't believe it. You know, when people come and they go and they can't see the gold that they found, they've just, you know, they've just got to the most beautiful thing in their lives and they've just walked away from it, or they're just brushing it to one side. And I thought, oh, that's so true. And then I remembered Guruji's most lovely chant, you know, the chant which is, I will be thine always. And if you look at the words to that song, you know, it says, devotees may come, devotees may go, but I will be thine always. And then he even says, I may go far, farther than the stars, but I will be thine always. Mm-hmm. Then he goes even further. When I die, look into mine eyes. When I, they will mutely say, I will be thine always, Lord, my Lord, I will be thine always. So this is the difference between, I suppose, Mukunda and Avatar, who's never averting his gaze from his goal, to probably us and Jitendras. But this is why we do these chants, isn't it? This is where we're trying to get to. This is hopefully grace will descend on us and make us realize these truths at some point in our lives. Mike?
Because of that, Guruji says that loyalty is the highest law in the spiritual life. Because I think without loyalty, nothing, all means nothing, kind of. And it's so easy to get distracted. I think there's this one story that is being told often. I think it's also in the lesson, the one with Narada getting a glass of water. And then he I don't know how it happens, but somehow he meets this woman and they get married and they have children, and then a flood sweeps them away. And then Krishna, or is it Rama? I don't remember. Says like, Narada, where's my water? What happened? But really easy to get lost in the world. It's not like, I don't blame people when that happens to them.
Mm. Yeah. The Leela, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So, Jitendra and Mukunda part ways. And Mukunda describes him as, he said he may be described, mildly described as vacillating in temperament. How kindly he's described his beloved childhood friend Jitendra. Now is obviously might be a good time to speak about Jitendra's, because we have a lovely image of Jitendra meditating in the book. It's quite nice. I've got a picture on the card for you. So he's wearing Rudraksh, and his eyes are pointed upwards like a true meditator. Hair not dissimilar to mine. I was his age, by as thin as Jitendra was, so I could be Jitendra if I'm honest. When I was, especially when I was that age, that thin.
Reincarnated in London. He looks so young, right? Did that not strike you? I would have, when I heard the story, I thought it would be a bit older, like a kid.
Wearing a Rudraksh in a very accomplished Padmasana, the lotus, the full lotus posture, with arms crossed. He's not following Guruji's advice. Palms should be upturned at the point between the juncture and the abdomen. Had he had followed that advice when meditating and looking at it, perhaps he would not have left. Perhaps he would not have left Guruji.
Wouldn't you love to be a meditation critic or someone? Send me your meditation video. I will give you feedback.
And then the other picture, we may as well talk about it. So Krishna is twice referred to in this, or maybe more than twice, referred to in this chapter, where he's, is described here as India's beloved avatar, Bhagwan, or Lord Krishna. And here he's sitting in, not a pose dissimilar to Jitendra's, but his palm is facing out of his heart, in a way of like a benediction or blessing to the person who's beholding this image. It's a very lovely, quite quaint, old-looking sketch of Krishna. There's no history of it. I'd love to know the history of some of these ancient and famous pictures of Krishna, but we don't get those, unfortunately. Here, and his other hand is holding his murli, or his flute, which is quite nice. So let's see what happens now. So he's essentially going, Mike.
Just a blessing that you are, that's like this avatar comes, brings the spiritual path for a new era. He writes his main book and you are in it, right? So Jitendra has some good karma, some stuff going for him, I would say. And he was probably a meaningful influence on Mukunda when he was young, so well deserved.
Indeed. Yeah. Mike, do you remember the bird and wings and the flying of the nest paradigm that Ananda came up with?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, remember he said, you know, the bird will soon tire of the metaphysical skies or something along those lines, and then fold his wings and then return securely into our family nest. So you might say Ananta was 100% right, but only it was about Jitendra and not Mukunda, because this is essentially what he's done. So his powers of intuition were pretty good, just slightly skewed in the wrong in the wrong direction. So he's then they Mukunda takes the local train to Serampore, so he doesn't say he goes home, he goes straight to his guru, which is just outside of Calcutta. Mike? Oh, yeah, no, don't worry. It says, a throb of wonderment stole over me as I realized that 28 days had passed since Banara's meeting with my guru. And he quotes, you will come to me in 4 weeks. And that is a prophecy that has now been fulfilled. And Mukunda says that it was a throb of wonderment. What a fantastic feeling it must have been to have realized that there and then. And then he says, here I was, heart pounding, standing within his courtyard. Mike?
So when he, when Sri Yukteswar predicted this, Guruji said never. He said it wouldn't happen. And part of it was this, like you mentioned, the bird and the nest analogy that Ananta made earlier, that he said he would be coming back. But in he didn't just mend fences with Ananta, but now he's his disciple, right? So he completely turned that situation into his favor, right? So, well done.
Oh, yeah. Very good point. So the so he has also become a bird.
Yeah.
He's joining the metaphysical skies. But he thought Mukunda was just a bird, but he was actually an eagle. So his heart is pounding, standing within the courtyard of the quiet Raigat Lane. It may have been quiet then, but I can assure you it is not quiet now. the vlog that I did in outside the ashram there in Serampore was so loud I had to record it on Zoom on a one-to-one meeting with myself. So Zoom suppresses all the chaos noise outside, even though it's the smallest street in history. It's just a chaos loudness.
Dedication to the cause, Priyank.
Yeah. Mike?
I vaguely remember going there. Did you take a boat over the river?
No.
From Dakshineswar Ashram? No?
Okay. No, you can do that, but we had a automobile.
Automobile, okay. No, well done.
He stands in front of the quiet Raigat Lane, has this lovely moment of reflection. And I thought I'd take us to that moment of reflection, because I was in this position. I put myself in this position before I entered any of our ashrams. So thankfully I had time, and I was with the right crowd, i.e. my wife, who was of a similar temperament to me in terms of the devotion. So I could, before, you know, going inside, I could really stop and reflect and put myself at the feet of Guruji and Sri Yukteswar in this case, or Lady Mahasha in Banaras, or after Babaji in Dwarahat. So you could really, it's really nice to do that. I remember, and the reason I made it a point to do this was when a few years ago, no, a decade ago, I went, two decades ago, wow, I'm getting old. I went to Vrindavan, Mathura, which is Krishna's birthplace. And I just walked in, you know, maybe slightly respect, you know, with a bit of devotion, I walked in and just offered my prayers and essentially left. And then I read in the scripture, in the Bhagavad Puran, how his cousin Uddhava, Krishna's cousin Uddhava, would enter any place where Krishna had been, i.e. Vrindavan or Mathura or Dwarka. Before stepping foot inside the precinct, he would do a full prostration. So he would stop, meditate, do a full prostration, thank God and gurus that he can step on the same hallowed soil that his guru Krishna had walked on. And I thought to myself, when I read that scripture, I thought, I can't believe I did all these things without that same frame of mind. But I suppose things come to you in the right at the right time. So when I went this time, I was in that frame of mind. So I'm fully with Guru Ji when he describes how he stood in front of the courtyard and reflecting on these things, because I did a similar thing. I basically became Uddhava in this little pastime. So, and I really highly recommend that if you go to any of Guruji's ashrams, then you take that moment as well, even before stepping inside. It's like essentially like the prayer for food. We don't just eat it, we, you know, think of God and thank God behind the food. And then also one of the brothers said that, Brother Vishwananda, I think, said, not only does he say the prayer for food, he actually waits 2 minutes afterwards in silence and meditation. So if you add that up, that's like four minutes of food's ready and 4 minutes of prayer and silence, at which point food will be cold, but your heart will be much more warmer than it was perhaps before. So yeah, so I really highly recommend you do what Mukunda has done here before you go to these spiritually significant places. It makes it very beautiful, or much more beautiful than it would have been otherwise. So he says, I entered for the first time the hermitage where I was to spend the best part of the next 10 years with India's Gnana Avatar, incarnation of wisdom. And this is the first time, I believe, he uses the description Gnana Avatar, which of course he's described as the incarnation of wisdom. And all of our gurus have got a designation such as this, a descriptive designation. So Babaji's is Mahavatar Babaji, and Lady Mahashaya's is a Yogavatar, an incarnation of yoga, and Guruji's is Prema Avatar, which is an incarnation of divine and unconditional and pure love. So which one's your favorite, Lauren? Description.
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, I've always really connected with Sri Yukteswar's one. I don't know why, it just kind of that the wisdom way in God. But they're also beautiful, aren't they, in their own way.
Premavtar Yogananda Paramahansa Yogananda. So some of our chants in India especially, they've used the designation in the chant, which is one of the ones that I just sung. It's quite nice. So that really brings the end of a very beautiful chapter, very funny chapter, very profound chapter, quite beautiful. I thought, for me, let's talk about the lessons here to start with. So for me, one of the big lessons was on faith and resolve, and how to both of them should be unwavering. And even when they're tested, and you should allow them to be tested, as Lauren kind of alluded to herself when she says she has these affirmations and then we get tested, but our faith and resolve is then tested and then strengthened. So I thought this chapter was a really good example of that, how Mukunda, you know, became you know, much even through this test, Ananta transformed, of course, but I think even Mukunda, it was probably good for him as well as Ananta. So it's definitely good for us to read it and absorb it. So I really like that. And also, you know, when we have our friends and perhaps even family members that we may introduce to Guruji, or, you know, maybe on a slightly different spiritual path to ours, and then they if they fall off the track a little bit, not to be dismayed, essentially. This is part of the Leela, just as Jitendra kind of came and went and, you know, made some pretty big statements and then didn't stick to them on more than one occasion. So that's also another thing to look out for. I watch what people do and how they are, as opposed to just what they're saying, which is quite nice. I don't know if you guys had any comments on the lessons, Laura.
Yeah, I do. I feel like I actually spoke on it last episode, but for me, the biggest lesson and reminder in this chapter was that first, we must fully rely on God, because when we do, he provides us what we need and more so. But also that he will send help through people. And it's up to us to discern, you know, what that help is. And like I said last episode, you know, I had a few experiences in America where this, not in this grand scale, but you know, where this sort of thing was brought to light and was happening. And it just goes to show that when we really put our faith and our trust in God and we really rely on him alone, he is there. So this chapter for me was a real kind of reminder of that.
And in such a light-hearted and jovial way,
yeah,
and then interweaves, yeah, really serious elements into it. Ooh. You know, how funny is it to read about Jitendra crying, even?
Poor Jitendra.
And how funny is it to see them poking each other in really tender and painful spots? And basically just really good banter between them, isn't it? Chris commented on that as well. Chris had to leave. He's on another call, and he said faith trumps all. And he also said that this was a really great example of the turning point of Ananta, which Mike, kind of, you mentioned we were talking about. But I think this whole chapter revealed the heart, dual hearts of the Ananta and Jitendra in different ways. Like before this chapter, and if you hadn't read the book, and you'd asked, out of Ananta and Jitendra, which way round is it going to be in terms of how this pans out? You know, we each would have said the opposite of what's actually ended up happening. So I think that proves essentially that, as what Mike was saying, that Ananta's intentions were always quite pure, essentially. But his view of the world was obviously not the highest view of the world, shall we say. But he was just trying to get Mukunda to what he believed be the best, you know, have the best life that one could live. And he certainly tried with a lot of zeal, didn't he, to switch it, and even put his own, not just reputation, but spiritual path on the line with this bet and with this whole chapter as it's described. And then he becomes initiated. And I think all these characters and the traits and the kind of pastimes and the troubles and the victories, they represent quite well, I think, our family, our interactions with our own family, our own friends, and probably ourselves too. When we talked about Jitendra and Ananta, i.e. family and friends, but we also, in one of the episodes, said we were Jitendra, weren't we? We oscillate through periods of, you know, intense faith and knowing what our path is, to doubting and negativity. I know, Mike, you've got that switch, but you must loan us the method to build one of those switches ourselves.
I find it's not a, everyone has that switch. I feel like most people just don't care about it. Most people are lured by the mind into playing the same program every day. And you are at liberty to change it. It's just most people just let it happen. I think it's more like that. And I think during the pandemic, especially, I journaled a lot. And I felt that I was journaling about the same stuff over and over again. That was kind of the place where I was at this time. And I felt, why? This is the past. And then how about I try to be more living in the now? And then because the we had this thing in this talk by Brother Satyananda recently that was amazing. Like, I think he started out by saying, what is something that you cannot change, but it can change you? It's the past. I feel that was kind of resonating with me a lot. Like, I was doing most of those things that he mentioned in this talk already, like living, having a minimalistic home, like not keeping any possessions, like only half what you actually need. He had one of the things he kept saying was, if you have possessions that you don't know if you need them, he said, if in doubt, throw it out.
I like that.
It's like the Marie Kondo approach, kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah. And in that sense, I feel like once you free up stuff, like it's like, I don't want to say it's like a bank account, but you free up, you throw stuff out of your mind and then new stuff comes in. And that's very healthy. And so I feel like in that sense, whenever I feel like my mind keeps going, playing me some, I don't know, one of its favorite DVDs from back in the day, then I just say, stop it. Think of something positive. Yeah.
Lauren, which was your favorite section of this chapter?
For me, it's the moment where Pratap comes up and he says, and it's that line, his eyes sought mine trustfully, said, but you are my guru. I was just so touching. And it's such a massive moment, isn't it?
So out of the blue as well.
Yeah, like you've got all these massive miracles and, you know, comedy moments, and then you have this really sincere, loving moment.
Proper plot twist that just floors you, doesn't it?
What about you, Priyank?
I really like this end scene with Ananda. His transformation was phenomenal. And the way Guruji has talked about Ananda through the whole book, and then talking about how he essentially changed, is just so beautifully dovetailed in all of the narrative that we've had of Guruji's life. And it just felt like we kind of experienced Ananda's in our lives in terms of, just by reading this book, we kind of feel like we have got to know Ananda more than anyone else in his family, really, actually.
Yeah.
More than his dad, more than his mom. Because they didn't have any great transformations, did they? They were pretty much saints from the beginning to the end of the book. His parents and his other siblings, the interactions with his other siblings are quite patchy, aren't they? Whereas Ananda has a nice trajectory from older brother, critic, devotee, disciple, and then he even, you know, passes away in halfway through the book. Mike?
Yeah, Lauren mentioned that earlier, that maybe he didn't do a 180. Maybe this spiritual things were working in his mind for a while and he just needed the right time. And there is this, in the beginning of the chapter, we had this theory, right? That maybe he's just staging this plot so he can become Mukunda's disciple in a way where he doesn't lose face. And this is still a possibility in my mind. Because he's the kind of guy who would think of a plot like this to work in his favor.
Indeed. And that, I think, is the end of that. So the next episode, we're going to obviously start chapter 12, Life in Master's Hermitage, I think it's called. But it's a very, very long and detailed chapter. So you can expect a very, very long and detailed breakdown. Chris has split this chapter into 20 episodes, 20 parts. So we'll see how that goes. But I'm really looking forward to this chapter because I think some of the most profound learnings are there, I suppose, as a disciple when Guruji himself is a disciple. And then we can kind of walk the trodden path, the well-trodden path of Mukunda Rao Ghosh to become Paramahansas ourselves one day, no doubt. Which is also a bird, a mystical bird. Divine swan.
A swan.
Indeed. And on that note, shall we leave it there? Thank you very much, yes. Lauren and Mike and Chris as well, who is
absolutely
Jai Guru. Thank you, Jai Guru.